in your overview book, it's on page one, you'll see that Vurijan Prabhu has compiled quotations by Srila Prabhupada from different of his purports in Bhagavad Gita, in which he's describing the basic messages and the basic ideas contained in the different chapters. That's page one. So I'll just read the quotation B about chapter 2. Srila Prabhupada writes, this is from the purport of chapter 2, verse 72. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur has summarized the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita as being the contents for the whole text. In Bhagavad Gita, the subject matters are Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, and Bhakti Yoga. In the second chapter, Karma Yoga and Jnana Yoga have been clearly discussed, and a glimpse of Bhakti Yoga has also been given as the contents for the complete text. So this chapter is entitled Contents of the Gita Summarized. And as we go through it, if you're very attentive, you'll see how actually basically all the subjects which are discussed in Bhagavad Gita, they do make an appearance in this chapter, even though generally it's in a very brief form. And even for that matter, practically every subject which is discussed in all the Vedic scriptures is referred to here in chapter 2 very briefly. Anyway, when we get to the end of the chapter, I'll just review the various subjects that are presented in it. But if you're attentive as we go through, you'll see how so many subjects come up very briefly. The attendance sheet is somewhere out there amongst you. Do please keep passing it around till everyone has marked themselves present. So there are five sections in chapter 2. The first one is from verse 1 to verse 10. Of course, we've already discussed certain of the verses in this section. The section is dealing with Arjuna's doubts, which we have discussed, and Krishna preparing to instruct Arjuna. So apparently, Dhritarashtra, when he heard from Sanjaya that Arjuna was so bewildered and so emotionally disturbed and throwing down his bow and everything, then Dhritarashtra, he was very happy. He thought, this is very nice. We are bound to win despite everything. But then, when Sanjay spoke this verse 1 of chapter 2, Dhritarashtra, his little bubble of happiness was burst. Because Sanjay uses the word, the name, Madhusudana for Krishna. Madhusudana is quite a well-known name of the Supreme Lord. It means he who killed the Madhu demon. Madhu demon was a big demon who appeared sometime earlier on in the universe. And Krishna appeared and killed that Madhu demon. I think it was Madhu and Kaitab. He killed it at more or less the same time. They were big, big demons. So the fact that Sanjay uses this name Madhusudana indicates that Krishna is going to kill these doubts of Arjuna. These doubts are like demons. So Krishna is going to kill those doubts in the same way he killed that Madhu demon. And when Arjuna is free from those doubts, then he'll fight very nicely. And it's very likely he'll win. In verse 2, you can see Krishna expresses his feelings about the doubts of Arjuna. Krishna doesn't appreciate them very much. He says, Anarya Jushtam. Anarya. You're speaking all these doubts, but these types of ideas, are embraced by people who are anarya. Anarya basically means not really up to the proper standard to be considered human beings. The Aryans, Aryan, the word Aryan basically means a person who understands the real values of life, real values in life. In other words, a qualified human being. But anarya means a person who doesn't understand the value of the human form of life and doesn't utilize the human form of life properly. So strictly speaking, such a person wouldn't really be classified as a proper human being. So this is a big insult for Arjuna. Big insult. Because he's meant to be one of the leaders of humanity, actually. But Krishna's saying, you're anarya. So Krishna, he doesn't play around at all with Arjuna. He comes right to the point in no uncertain terms whatsoever. He doesn't sentimentally tell him that, well, you know, I think you've spoken very nicely and I appreciate your feelings and it's very nice, but, you know, maybe we can come up with a slightly better idea. No, he just tells him, look, you are anarya. You're practically not speaking like someone who's not even a human. You're a fool. So quite a cutting response from Krishna. But it's important to note that even, like we mentioned yesterday, even though in certain regards these doubts of Arjuna, some of them may sound quite nice, but Krishna doesn't appreciate them at all. Not at all. They shouldn't be taken seriously. Verse 3, he calls him impotent. Arjuna's a big kshatriya. So kshatriyas are generally very potent in all ways. Very powerful persons. But Krishna's calling Arjuna impotent. Just like a weakling. And he says that these sentiments of yours, they are petty weaknesses. Give up this petty weakness of heart. So this is all very petty, all these ideas of yours. In verse 4, Arjuna tries to counter that in a rather sort of half-hearted way by saying that it's not weakness, but it's generosity. I'm trying to be kind to these people. How can I attack them? They're such great souls. But of course we should understand that a kshatriya is happy to be attacked because it gives him the chance to fight. Anyway, Arjuna's saying that it's not weakness, it's generosity. I'm trying to be a very broad-minded, nice fellow. Then 5 and 6 we discussed yesterday. We discussed those yesterday under saintliness and fear of sinful reaction. Then in 6, Arjuna's manifesting his indecision. Despite having so many high-sounding ideas, he really isn't convinced. He just doesn't really know what to do. 7 is significant. In verse 7, this is the first mention of spiritual master-disciple relationship, which of course is very important in Krishna consciousness. Krishna goes on later on in the 4th chapter to state very clearly that the spiritual master is a necessity in spiritual life. I'll just read a little bit of this purport. Verse 7, I'll read the first paragraph. By nature's own way, the complete system of material activities is a source of perplexity for everyone. In every step there's perplexity, and therefore it behooves one to approach a bona fide spiritual master who can give one proper guidance for executing the purpose of life. All Vedic literatures advise us to approach a bona fide spiritual master to get free from the perplexities of life, which happen without our desire. They're like a forest fire that somehow blazes without being set by anyone. Similarly, the world's situation is such that perplexities of life automatically appear without our wanting such confusion. No one wants fire, and yet it takes place, and we become perplexed. The Vedic wisdom therefore advises that in order to solve the perplexities of life and to understand the science of the solution, one must approach a spiritual master who's in the disciplic succession. A person with a bona fide spiritual master is supposed to know everything. One should not, therefore, remain in material perplexities, but should approach a spiritual master. This is the purport of this verse. It's interesting, Prabhupada says, a person with a bona fide spiritual master is supposed to know everything. I don't know, I'm sure most of you, if maybe all of you, have spiritual masters. I don't know if you feel you know everything yet. Perhaps not. Prabhupada was asked once, do you know everything? Because that idea is there. I mean, even here, a disciple is meant to know everything, and spiritual masters are quite often described as being all-knowing or something like that. So Prabhupada was asked once, do you know everything? And Srila Prabhupada said, no, I don't know everything. But Krishna does, and he tells me. So, Srila Prabhupada. Anyway, the point is that a person who's properly situated in relationship with the spiritual master, in relationship with Krishna, will never really be in want of knowledge. Will never really be in that position where they just don't know what to do or how to approach a situation. By the grace of the spiritual master and by the grace of Krishna. Then, verse 8 we discussed yesterday. Verse 9, Arjuna basically is now finishing his expressing his doubts and his feelings of weakness. Any of you later comers not have one of these overviews? Three of you, is it? There's the two people just behind you also. And the attendance sheet, it's very nice that you're passing it around, but don't hold on to it. It should make its way back here sooner or later. Yeah, so verse 9, Arjuna finishes expressing his doubts. And in verse 10, Krishna prepares to reply. An interesting point in verse 10 is the use of the word in the second line of the Sanskrit, prahasan. Prahasan, Prabhupada, well, it's translated in the word for word as smiling. A more literal translation is like smiling, almost smiling, something along those lines. Not really smiling, but not, you know, not just expressionless, like smiling. So it indicates that Krishna, having previously been in a friendly mood, and Arjuna, he was also in that friendly type of mood, but now the mood is changing. Arjuna is surrendering. Of course, it takes a while for Arjuna to really surrender, but at least he's beginning. And Krishna is observing that, and he's responding to that. So Krishna is becoming more grave, and he's stepping out of that role of friend and into the role of spiritual master or spiritual authority. So that brings us into section B, verses 11 to 30. This is a well-known section. I'm sure you're all familiar with many of the verses in it. It's entitled Gyan. And the basic idea is that the soul is eternal. So why should Arjuna not fight them? Why should he not fight, seeing the soul as eternal? It's not exactly the same as Jnana Yoga. Although that, perhaps we could open the doors a bit. The noise has died down and the heat is building up. This knowledge here in these 20 or so verses, this knowledge is like the basic knowledge of Jnana Yoga. But here, of course, just the basic elements of knowledge are being presented, not actually the practices of Jnana Yoga as such. So it's Jnana, knowledge of the soul, and seeing the soul is immortal, then why should Arjuna not fight? Why should he worry about the bodies of his friends and relatives? So there are three subsections that jumps around a bit. The first subsection is verse 11 to verse 13, then there's a break, and it goes on from 16 to 25. So 11, Krishna calls Arjuna directly a fool. He says that those who are wise, they don't act like you're acting. So that means you're not wise. You're unwise, or in other words, you're a fool. Krishna's really speaking in a very, very strong way. Verse 12 is an interesting verse. It actually establishes the personal nature of spiritual life. This, the conflict between the impersonalists and the personalists, is not just a recent development in Indian spiritual history. You know, it's not that it just came about with Shankaracharya or anyone like that, but it's always been there. So Krishna here, this is actually the first verse that Krishna speaks in which he's really saying something about the soul, saying something spiritual. So what does he say? That I've existed as an individual, and you have existed, all these kings have existed. We've all existed as individuals, and we'll all continue to exist as individuals. So, has everyone marked themselves present? So Krishna is establishing right here in the very beginning that spiritually we are eternal individuals. And of course he makes the point again in a few other places further on. But it's interesting that it comes up right at this very, very early point. Verse 13, Krishna's saying that, of course we all know this verse, I would assume. One interesting point about this verse is that of all the verses in Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, of all the verses in scriptures that we deal with, this verse was lectured on by Srila Prabhupada the second most. There's one other verse in which appears in Bhagavad Gita, which Prabhupada lectured on more than this. But this verse was lectured on more than any other verse in any other scripture other than that one verse. That one verse that Prabhupada lectured on the most was chapter 7, verse 1. In fact, he lectured on that verse twice as frequently as this. There are about 13 or 14 or 12, something like that, recorded lectures of Prabhupada on 2.13. But there's over 20 on chapter 7, verse 1. So it certainly says something about this verse. It's a very important verse. I'm sure you're all familiar with this verse. So Krishna is saying here, well, Arjuna, he was so worried about killing Bhishma, Drona and company. But Krishna here is saying that you won't be killing them. You won't really be killing them because they are the soul, they're eternal. So why worry? You don't need to not fight. You can fight. Then, according to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, between verse 13 and 14, Arjuna comes up with another doubt. It's also rather petty. According to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Arjuna says that's okay, but my relationship is with these people while they're in their present bodies now. So if I kill them and they leave these bodies and go away to another lifetime somewhere else, then I'm going to lose their association. And I don't want to lose their association. So therefore I don't want to kill them. But then in reply to that, it's rather an interesting point that Arjuna makes. And it's definitely not very spiritually oriented. But in reply to that, Krishna speaks, verse 14, that you have to tolerate these things. These things happen. That's the way life works in this material world. Happiness, distress, heat, cold. So, they're going to die anyway. So what does it really matter if they die now or they die later? You're going to have to tolerate it sooner or later. Of course, verses 14 and 15 are kind of taken out as a little subsection themselves. Verse 15 is important because in verse 15, Krishna establishes what is like practically the most fundamental principle of yoga. Krishna says, the person who's not disturbed by happiness and distress and is steady in both is certainly eligible for liberation. Now, of course, when we speak of yoga, we speak of, there's so many different types of yogas, but they're all processes for achieving liberation. Some are personal, some are impersonal. But the basic idea, which runs through all, at least as far as the goal is concerned, is liberation. And the basic principle in yoga is detachment. Detachment. Detachment is there in bhakti yoga. It's there in karma yoga, jnana yoga, ashtanga yoga. It's like the fundamental principle of any process which can be called yoga. So it's a very important point, and we'll see how it's important as we go further through this chapter. So then from verse 16 to verse 25, going back to the first subsection, basic knowledge of the soul, again, in verse 16, Krishna, he's giving Arjuna another slap in the face. Those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the soul there's no change, and for the body, that the body practically doesn't exist. So the seers of the truth know this, but you don't, Arjuna. So that means that you're not a seer of the truth. It means you're an illusion. So it's another little slap in the face. Verses 17 and 18, in these two verses, Krishna establishes that what is this eternal thing, first of all, that he's referred to in verse 16. And then in verse 18, he describes what is this non-existent thing. Verse 17 is describing the imperishable soul. And verse 18, Krishna is talking about the material body. Material body is called non-existent, not exactly in the sense that it really doesn't exist, as Shankaracharya would have us believe. According to Shankaracharya, we don't have bodies. There's only Brahman. And the fact that we appear to have bodies is an illusion. Actually, there are no bodies. There's only Brahman. So, when we say, or when Krishna says that the body is non-existent, he doesn't mean in that sense, that is basically in the sense that our bodies are constantly changing. Every 7 years, all the cells change, apparently. But in the meantime, even from moment to moment, the certain cells are changing, the structure of the body is changing, even though it's very, very slightly. So the body is not existing at any point in like a fixed state. In other words, you could say that your body now and your body at the end of the class are not really the same body. Not exactly the same body. There's actually been a change. So in that sense, these bodies are taken to be or can be looked at as being non-existent. In 19, Krishna is making the point that the soul is neither the doer nor is action done to him. The soul's transcendental to this whole process of doing things and having things done to you. From verse 20 to 25, Krishna is giving like a basic definition of what is the soul. The basic characteristics of the soul from verse 20 to 25. For the soul has neither birth nor death at any time. He's not come into being, does not come into being, and will not come into being. He's unborn, eternal, ever-existing and primeval. He's not slain when the body is slain. In between 20 and 21, according to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Arjuna comes up with another one of his objections. That objection is that I agree, Arjuna says, I agree that the soul's eternal. I'm not disputing that. But I don't want to be the cause of them changing bodies. Why should I be the cause? But then Krishna replies that you are not going to be able to stop them changing their bodies if you don't fight. So therefore, why not fight? Why not? Anyway, that is there. So from verse 20 to 25, I won't read through all the verses, but Krishna is defining, giving certain definitions or descriptions of certain features of the soul. Then verses 26 to 30, this is the third subsection. The idea is that the soul can't be killed and the body can't be saved, so why not fight? Verse 26, Krishna does an interesting thing. Arjuna has said that, or Krishna is sort of like a checkmate, that's the term that Bhurijan uses. Krishna says, if you think there's a soul, you should fight, because the soul will live on. Fighting or killing won't affect the soul, the real person. And if you think there's no soul, that we're only material bodies, then you should also fight. Because the body, it comes into being, it wasn't existing to start off with, it's existing for a while, sooner or later it's going to stop existing. So what does it matter if you stop it existing? It's going to stop existing sooner or later anyway. Krishna is bringing up this point about the soul or the symptoms of life possibly always being born and dying. Of course, the basic idea that Krishna has been presenting is that the soul is eternal. But he's saying here that if you think that there isn't really a soul, but we're just bodies, then you should still fight. The reason he's bringing this up, Prabhupada explains in the purport, is that there's